I'm Vicki and I'm an alcoholic. Whenever I introduce myself and I hear the greeting, it's such a warm sound. I don't know if any of you attended the Montreal convention back a while ago. I think it was 85. And there were, I think it was 60,000 of us in a stadium. And they were doing the introductions to the main speaker and talking about, you know, who had had the most years and who had had the fewest. And they hauled this poor kid up on the stage who'd had 24 hours of sobriety. And I don't remember his name, but somebody told him to go up in front of the podium and say, you know, his name. And he said something like, "Hi, Bob, I'm an alcoholic." And 60,000 people said, "Hi, Bob, welcome." I think he either got scared into sobriety that night or he immediately went out and started drinking again. And I always wanted to know the end of that story. So if any of you run into this kid, I would love to know what happened. But what it was like, how I got here, what it's like now. You know, I was relating a lot to the Alateen speaker when she was talking. I grew up in a dysfunctional family. My mom had mental illness. I think my dad is an alcoholic. I don't know. He walks like a duck, you know. And I spent a lot of when I was young. I can remember that anger, and I can remember the despair, and I can remember when it wasn't anger or despair, it was nothing. I had no feelings, and I didn't know. I didn't understand when other people cried or when other people laughed. You know, I had to pretend, you know, kind of, because I didn't know what to do. I was tough as nails, too. I can remember by the time I got into junior high school, I broke my leg in the backyard one day doing a flip and missed my landing. And I broke my thigh bone in two and ripped the ligaments and tendons out of my knee. And I didn't accept help from anyone. I got myself up. I walked myself into the house, up the stairs, and put myself to bed and told my parents I didn't need any help. I was tough as nails. I didn't know how to ask for help. I didn't trust anyone. And the only emotions I had were anger and despair. That was the first time I can remember drinking, too. I was about 14 years old, and I was angry at something. I'm sure it was my parents. And I took an empty Coke bottle. I don't know how big they were, the glass bottles. And I emptied out the Coke. Why bother with soda? And went into my dad's liquor cabinet and just took a little bit out of every bottle. Well, I'm sure a lot of you can relate to that. Filled it up and then went for a walk. And walked a couple miles to a girlfriend's house and drank it on the way. And I felt great. I discovered two things. I had an immense capacity for alcohol. It took me a lot to get drunk, and it made me feel better than I have ever felt before. It took away all the anger. It took away all the despair, and all I felt was silly and fun, and I had a good time. I don't remember getting hungover that night. I do know later in high school, I was getting hungover. But it took immense quantities for me to get drunk, and it was very hard for people to tell. My drinking continued into college. By the time I was in college, I was hallucinating. Sometimes it was actually before I started drinking, I would be watching somebody's head get huge or small or float off their body, and I'd take that drink and everything would go okay again. And my denial was such that I figured as long as I got that head back on the body and it was the right size, everything was fine. I didn't do any hallucinogenic drugs, and I dabbled in the dope and, you know, marijuana and the cocaine, stuff like that, but alcohol was always my first drug of choice, and it never really scared me because my denial was so great until the night drinking by myself, and I started hearing chanting voices in my head telling me that I was no good. It was a chorus, lovely sound. Telling me that I was no good, I couldn't do anything, you know, on and on and on for the whole evening. And I went running to my student advisor and explained that to him. And he said at the time, perhaps you shouldn't drink. And perhaps you shouldn't take any hallucinogenic drugs. And I said, okay, I won't take any hallucinogenic drugs. But I couldn't imagine life without drinking. It was also in college that I got into my first trouble, real, real big trouble with alcohol. I got drunk. I got raped. I went for help to a doctor. I was sexually assaulted at gunpoint. I don't blame myself for having that happen, but if I hadn't been drunk, I never would have been in that situation. If I had been sober and had learned to live life on life terms, perhaps I would have been able to trust my instincts a little better, that something was wrong. But even that, I didn't hook up that with alcoholism. I did what I always did when something was wrong, like when I was hallucinating or whatever. I just said, it's okay, it's over, it's done. It's okay now. It's not going to happen again. And I just took that memory and just shoved it down inside and forgot about it, to tell you quite honestly. I met the guy I was going to marry at this point. And, you know, the story, the theme is love, life, and laughter. And at the time, I thought I loved him. But what I was really looking for, and this was immediately after the assault, you know, what I was really looking for was someone to protect me. And this guy was big, and he liked to drink. And he was a little on the wild side, and I related to him completely. I thought it was love, but for me it really was I needed a caretaker. I wanted someone to take care of me and keep the bad guys away. And I figured, you know, if I stayed with one guy and I had a ring, then I wouldn't have to deal with men sexually after that, because I'd be married. And, well, that's a, you know, I wasn't actually going to get married because I had sworn I would never get married having grown up with my parents. Whew, I didn't want anything to do with that, but... being mature young kids, which is what we were in our 20s, we thought we knew everything. Our parents had ostracized us because we were living together. You know, his family wouldn't let me in his house. My family wouldn't let me in my house, so I wasn't going to anybody's family. And because we so desperately needed to please our parents, and because we were so needy to each other, we got married. That's not love either, you know. But we did get married. And the drinking progressed. My husband is also in the program, in AA, and he was a blackout drinker, and I hallucinated. Great couple. but you know, it wasn't every day, you know? And it's a weird thing about alcoholism. It's an illness of denial. You think, well, okay, that had happened, but it won't happen again, you know? And or you know, my husband would come out of a blackout, or and I'd say, you know, you threw the vacuum cleaner out the door last night, you know, and he'd say, no, I didn't, and he'd open the door and there would be the vacuum cleaner, and of course I kind of knew I hallucinated a little bit, so I was never really sure, and after a while I figured, well, maybe he didn't throw the vacuum cleaner out the door, but he had, you know, when he was in blackout, he'd do some crazy things. And, you know, our life became crazier and crazier. We got older. I decided what we really needed to have was a kid. You know, can you imagine? And I think what I was looking for then was love, too. You know, I thought if I had a child, that then something would love me. And I think that's a very sick way to look at it today. I was looking for something to love me. Here I was in my late 20s by this time. I thought that if I had a baby, what a burden. The baby was going to be the grown-up and going to give the love to the parent. Thank God today that we were not able to have kids. I don't think I would have wanted to bring them into our life. It was crazy. And but I did try, and my alcoholism progressed a lot. Over the course of about 10 years, I went from doctor to doctor to doctor, and we tried all sorts of different things so we could have kids. And every 2 weeks I'd stay dry because I'd convince myself I was pregnant, and then I'd find out that I wasn't, and it was a bottle a night. By this time, you know, during the week it was wine, during lunch it was scotch, and I always kept the vodka in the vodka for the summer, scotch for the winter, and I only drank the best. And I kept it in the freezer because I felt that ice cubes and mixers were just, you know, messing up the thing here, so... At one point I went into the doctor's office and he said, no, you're not pregnant again. And I just broke down crying. And this was unusual for the kid who was tough as nails. I couldn't stop crying. I never cried. I had a pretty good, how much time do I got? Still got some time left? Okay. I heard the beep go off. I had a good job. God gave me the gift of intelligence, which I didn't seem to have very much common sense, however. I was a practicing corporate attorney. I was so crazy, I was getting up from my desk and walking full stride into walls, missing the doorway. No. My secretary had come into my office and told me I was crazy, that she had tried to quit three weeks ago, but they couldn't find anyone in Aetna who was willing to come work for me. You know, I had a reputation. I was known as the ice lady and the bitch. You know, but I started crying in this doctor's office, and I couldn't stop, and I never cried. And this was just so strange. And the doctor said to me, "Perhaps you need to go talk to someone." So I went home, and I said to my husband, "Ken, I need to go to therapy. The doctor says I need to go." And he said, "No, you don't. Nothing's wrong." At which point, I collapsed, literally, like a faint, collapsed onto the floor and crawled on my hands and knees over to the dining room table, put my fingers on the edge of the table, and hauled my head up and said, "No, you know, I really do think something's wrong." You know, I think God gives you messages, and I think your body is one of them. You know, yeah. And he had hit me across the face with a wet fish. You know, bam, wake up. You know, I'm taking a bottle of aspirin a week, a roll of Tums every day. I have no friends. My husband and I don't talk to each other. He goes into the basement and drinks at night. I go home from work to a bar and then come home late. We have no furniture in the house. Now, I want you to understand, I had rashes, weeping sores all over my body. I had, you know, I would sprain my arm just from tension. You know, it was just, you know, your body's screaming out at you that something is really wrong, but that denial is so strong, you don't hear it. I thought, at this point in my life, that I was an international jet setter. I really did. I was that crazy. I would throw $1,000 down to take airplanes for a one-day trip out to Nantucket with my spouse. We were spending money like water. I had no furniture in the house. My clothes were like 6-7 years old, held together with scotch tape and staples. There are holes in my underwear. I smelled, you know. But in my head, I was an international jet setter. Just, it's, unless you've been there, it's very hard for me to explain. What happened, I ended up in therapy. The therapist suggested a joint session. My husband came drunk. I still didn't get it. We went to a party. He went into a real bad blackout and smashed the dashboard with his fist and crashed the dashboard in two on the way home from the car, in the car. And I got home, it was about 2 o'clock in the morning, and called up the therapist and said, "You know, I think my husband's crazy." And she said, "Vicki, you're missing the forest for the trees. Your husband is an alcoholic." And I didn't have a clue. Now, remember, I'm drinking too, so this was like, now I knew what was wrong with him. He was an alcoholic. He eventually went into treatment. At treatment, they did an intake on me. They told me that I may have a drinking problem. So I heard may, and that's all I heard. I went to Al-Anon because I knew what my problem was. I did get into Al-Anon, and I am a grateful recovering member of Al-Anon as a result. I got into Al-Anon. I stopped drinking at this time because I thought it was the thing to do for him. I went through seizures. I still didn't get it, you know. I thought it was just that he was so awful that I was such a physical mess after stopping drinking. And we'd go to the conventions and do different things, and I'd really always relate more to the AA speaker, but I still didn't get it. 1 year after I stopped drinking, was the first 2 years after I stopped drinking were the worst 2 years of my life, because I started to come to, and I realized I was not an international jet setter, that I was pretty crazy, and that my life had been pretty crazy, that my marriage was crazy, my growing up was crazy. My first conversation with a therapist had been, "How are you? Fine. How's your life? Fine. You know, how's your marriage? Fine. How was growing up? Fine." I didn't have a clue. I was so out there in La La Land, I could not deal with reality at all. And things came crashing down when I stopped drinking. All of a sudden, I had to turn around and face reality, and it was painful. And I didn't think I could take any more pain. I thought I'd had enough pain. I could not possibly go through any more pain. And I started walking up and down the Connecticut River and decided to find a place to kill myself. And I picked out my place, and I was ready to jump in. And by the way, I found out since that it's only 4 feet deep. The place that I picked out. But I didn't know that at the time. And it coming to was just so terrible. And I didn't believe in a higher power. As a matter of fact, when my husband had been in treatment earlier, they had given me a book and it had the word God in it. And it was the ODAT. And I closed the book and handed it back to them and said, no, thank you. I don't want anything to do with that. But at that time, I had been attending Al-Anon meetings, which is where I had started coming to. And for some reason, I turned to God. And I can remember just reaching out to God. And I didn't know how to do it, but I had recently heard the song Amazing Grace. So I started humming it to myself. And all of a sudden, I was filled with such a sense of peace and serenity. Excuse me, when I get to this, I wish I had it with me always. I don't, but it's a nice thing to remember. There was a light. I was filled with such a sense of wonder. And I realized at that point that I was a child of God and that God did love me. And I had never felt loved before in my life. And the same time I felt that, I realized that my Al-Anon friends loved me too, and that my husband really did love me, and that if I could only hang in and walk through this darkness, that there would be a light at the end of the tunnel, and that if I could have the faith and believe that it would work. Well, the moment passed, and it went away, but I'll always have that memory when things get down, you know, that I can always go back to that and know that I am a child of God. Oh, you know, I continued to discover more about myself and who I was. I realized after talking with my therapist for a while that I was phobic. I hadn't been inside a store, a library, a grocery store, a drugstore, anything for 5 to 7 years. All my clothes, I had manipulated my relatives and husband into buying me clothes for birthday and Christmas. Everything I wore had been bought by someone else. I had severe panic attacks, and they were worse without a drink. The only time I'd ever been able to go shopping had been when I was drinking. And, you know, this is part of the coming, too. Well, I got pregnant through the grace of God, and was pregnant with my first child. And I can remember being so upset because here I was. I was 36 years old. I was an attorney in a corporate law office, and I couldn't go into a grocery store to buy diapers for my child or anything like that. And I knew something was wrong, but I didn't know what it was. And I finally started to listening. Other things in my life had started to get better, but this was one area that I was still very sick with. The hallucinations had stopped, the hives, the weeping sores, all that stuff went away. But by now, this is about a few years after I had stopped drinking. I got a sponsor in Al-Anon, who's Jennifer. I don't know if any of you knew her. And she asked me to tell her my story, which I did. And she said, do you know I'm an alcoholic and I belong to AA? And I said, no, I didn't know that. And she said, you know, you really belong there too. And I went to my first meeting. Now, I thought I had been that I had accepted alcoholism as a disease. And I had, as long as it was my husband's disease. I can't tell you the kind of shame I felt walking into my first AA, closed AA meeting. As a matter of fact, I walked to the meeting, turned around and started to walk away when someone, one of my husband's friends, happened to see me and grab me and pull me in. There had been other indications at different times that I had spoken and told my Al-Anon story. The AA speaker had said, you know, you ought to come for a visit, you know. But and, you know, Al-Anon, I think, saved my life. You know, I really do think it kept me from trying to commit suicide. And it certainly had brought, made me come to. But it was in AA that, you know, my sanity was restored for me. That was so important. I belong to the Saturday Morning Hand of Hope group step meeting. They're probably having their coffee break right about now. And I've been, you know, faithful to that group. I go to other groups, but that my step meeting is really, really important to me. It's funny, the first after I admitted I was an alcoholic, all the phobias went away. Isn't that interesting? You know, they say secrets keep you sick, and I really do think that's true. You know, I thank God for the program. It's helped us so much get through life on life terms. We've had a lot of things that have happened to us in sobriety. I can't imagine how people get through this without a program. My husband's folks have died in a car accident. We had a second son who was very ill in the hospital. You know, what a blessing. He's in intensive care. One day they tell us he's dying. The next day they tell us he's going to live. And the next day he's dying. It's insanity. He's in there for 2 months. I'm trying to bribe the nurses with chocolates. I think if they give him chocolates, they'll pay more attention to my son. All my character defects are coming out full-blown. And all of a sudden I realized I'm doing this wrong. You know, it is up to God, to the doctors, and my son, whether or not he lives. And that I have to give it up, let go of it, and let God. And I was able to do that and walk through the rest of that experience with some sort of serenity. And I thank God for the program for this. He is alive today. You may see him later this afternoon. He's a cute little kid, but full of the dickens. after that, you know, I was estranged from my family for 4 years at my choice. I needed to set some boundaries and do some growing up. At one point, I discovered a couple of years ago that I had cancer. And that was a real, I had a real rough time. I had 5 surgeries. No one does well in chemotherapy, trust me. But the chemotherapy was really rough for me. And I had had a massive infection. They had a lot of difficulty taking care of it. But thank God for the program. You know, you do it one day at a time. You go out there, you ask for help. I learned to ask for help. And, you know, when something's wrong, I don't wait for people to call on me. You know, I pick up the phone call if I need a ride somewhere, you know, or I need something. I learned to ask for help in this program. And it got me through with a sense of grace and dignity. And I can remember the social worker who I'd become friends with. She knew a little bit about me, but not a lot. And she stopped me one day and she says, "How do you do this?" She says, "What are you doing? I need to let other people know how to do what you're doing to get through what you've gone through." And the first thing I thought, I didn't say it, but the first thing I thought was, well, first you become an alcoholic. You know? But it's true. I mean, thank God for those 12 steps. I know how to deal. You know, 1, admitted I was powerless over, and then fill in the blank, you know. 2, came to believe that there was a power greater than myself that could restore me to sanity, and then turn my will and life over to that power. Take a close look at what I'm doing that's contributing to the situation that's causing problems. Make amends if I need to make them. Don't make amends if I don't. Ask God for guidance on a daily basis, and go look for someone that I can help. You know, that's how I get through. I had a rough time this year with my program. You know, it's one thing for you to be sick. It's something else for your spouse to be sick. And we discovered, I forgot to mention my husband lost his job and we lost all our stuff. We kept the house, but we lost all our savings. We lost all our retirement. You know, we kept the house, thank God. I'm just coming out of the chemotherapy. My husband now has a new job. We're feeling okay. This is going to work. And I found out my husband has Parkinson's disease. At that point, I kind of closed the door on the program for a little bit. I was so angry. You know, how do you deal with life on life's terms? And I think any human being would have been angry under those circumstances. And I was so angry at God, and I realized that was okay. It's okay to be mad at God. The thing that's stupid is to stay away from the program. So I went back into the program. I explained I was having trouble to my sponsor. I talked at meetings. You know, I asked for help. I talked and talked and talked. And, you know, that's the miracle of the program, you know. For some reason, my husband and I got invited to speak together a number of different times around this time, so he could talk about his heart. It was kind of hard for us to talk to each other about it, you know. But he could talk about it. I could hear him. I could talk about it. He could hear me. And it was a great sense of healing. And it also brought us closer together. We realized that with all the stuff that had been going on and the raising the two kids and the busyness and all this stuff, that we had grown apart. And it was time to get comfortable talking to each other again about how we felt and what we were thinking. And it's been a real blessing in that way to bring us closer together in our marriage. And, you know, the program works. You take it a day at a time. You know there's a light at the end of the tunnel. Things are good now. Life is not always down. You know, things happen. I haven't had any, you know, incidents of cancer. You know, I just had a CAT scan. I feel like I won the lottery. Nothing's there, you know. I decided after all these years I had stopped practicing for a long time because I wasn't well enough to do it. And I knew that I needed to concentrate on myself, and I was also raising kids. And I realized I wanted to start practicing again. I am. I'm doing what I always wanted to do. I have a little country practice, you know, in the town where I live. I've just been asked to be town attorney, which is a big, you know, exciting thing for me to have happen. You know, I feel like saying, do you have any idea who you just asked? You know, I used to hallucinate. But this, you know, this program is a blessing. Sometimes life is up. Sometimes life is down. But you don't have to drink when it's down, and it's the worst possible thing you could do. I had a sponsor once who said, there's nothing so terrible that a drink won't make worse, and I think that's true. What you need to do is to just practice the principles in all your affairs. Reach out for help, ask for your friends and your sponsors, tell them what's going on, and it'll be okay. And it will be okay. Even if something awful happens, it'll be okay. So thank you very much for having me come speak to you this morning. Bye-bye.